Accession number 10232, reel number 3.
Rosslyn, reel 3.
In all, I shouldn't think more than a dozen of the terrorists, and they would be the top terrorists, who could speak English sufficiently fluently to be able to discuss in any great detail with you. And the common language, as the majority were Chinese, of course, was Chinese.
So what method did you favour? Did you favour the hard, the soft, or the patient?
Well, initially, as one does not, you had to judge your individual character, and initially you would use just the patient manner, which was, well, you know, and I know, in fact we all know, what you've been up to, so why don't you just come clean? We've got a lot of chaps coming out. As far as you're concerned, the struggle is over, and as far as your whole terrorist organization is concerned, it's simply a matter of time. So why don't we just get down to it, and you tell us who you are. Frequently they will give you a name, not necessarily their own. They know better than to just sit glumly silent. They will talk very excitedly, protest their innocence very often. If they're actually caught in with a communist uniform on, a terrorist uniform on, then they haven't got much hope. But after some time, most of them, I think, they come clean and they just say who they are. But a lot of them are reluctant to give you more information than they need. They will, if you point out who they are, alternatively, as the emergency wore on, we had more people available for identification, because when people surrendered, we used to call them SEP, surrendered enemy personnel, they would be called upon to identify. You use all kinds of means. If your SEP was one who it was not known generally had surrendered, then you might have to use some furtive means for him to recognize the latest surrender that you're not surrender or capture that you've got, and you might sort of let him look through a hole in the wall somewhere, and then he'd say, yes, that's so and so, and he used to be with so and so. Then you'd use that information. If you had that information, you'd then say, right, then you go on interrogating the man in the ordinary manner, and then you'd say, now when you left a certain place that your informant had told you, I've never been there. Oh yes you have, because your name is not Wing Chong Ching, your name is Seng Pang Nu or whatever, and that was the real name that he got, and we know you were there because you have been recognized. And you would judge from reactions whether he was getting frightened or not. But
what kind of things would you look for?
Well,
from his reaction,
if he was shifty, or if he made, a sudden, if he reacted suddenly in an alert way, you'd think, have we hit right? Hit the mark right away. But he wouldn't then say, yes, okay, the game's up, that's my name. No, you would continue to work at him, and then once you had established that you had got somebody, the next best thing to do would be hand him over to a man who speaks his own dialect and just sit them together and just let them talk it out. And they can talk it out, and it takes days sometimes.
Would you go by the tone of voice by which they answered, or by visual reactions?
No, they were quite clever liars. I mean, they would go on lying sometimes for days, maybe even weeks.
Would you try to trap them into inconsistencies?
Yes. Sometimes they would come unstuck. Your interpreters would say, "I'm getting very close. You know, he's getting close to breaking, but I don't think I've got him yet." Never unkind. They always had meals, give them cigarettes to smoke, and drinks. No alcohol.
Would you deprive them of anything?
No, I don't think they were ever deprived of anything. I mean, the first thing they wanted. They might be a little bit suspicious sometimes to start if you offer them food and drink. Possibly, I don't know, some rumours might have got back to them that, you know, when you're caught they'll poison you or whatever, and they might be a little bit suspicious. But the only thing to do in those circumstances is to get two bowls of food brought in and get your Chinese interrogator to start eating.
Why did you say that they knew better not to say anything? Because by not saying anything, they wouldn't give anything away, would they?
That's true. But then, you see, this is where their argument that we mistreat them breaks down. Because if they say nothing, I mean, they know nothing will happen to them. They don't get beaten or kicked or dropped out of a helicopter.
But why then didn't they just remain silent if they had nothing to lose by being silent?
Because if you continue to interrogate, people frequently break down and eventually say, "Oh God, the same old crap. I've told you before. No, 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 I don't know anything." And they say, "But you do." And you've got to have a good patient interrogator too. And I think, which is what I believe, is the patient side. The rough, when I say the hard side, it is only the shouting side that can, if you assess your character properly, the shouting side can intimidate. But shouting doesn't affect many of them, because some of them are fairly tough. Most of them are fairly tough people to have lived in the jungle for so long. To shout at them doesn't affect quite so much as the soft approach and the patient approach, the continual approach.
What type of person would be affected by shouting, do you think?
I would say a timid person more, I say, would be affected by the shouting. And there weren't so many timid people. I have seen the shouting technique carried out, but a very, very common practice being used for years, I should say long before the during the First World War, I think, and the Second World War, is to use a pair of people, you know. One is a bullying, shouting kind, who bangs on like mad and says, "I'll be back for you." Then in comes the second man who says, "Look, I apologise for my friend. You know, we're not very proud of him, and he's got totally the wrong technique. Have a cigarette." I mean,
does that work?
Well, yes, it can and does, but not always immediately. You know, they, don't forget, in the jungle, they have lots of training. And interrogation training is part of their training, and they will tell you that the same thing is likely to happen to you if you have the misfortune of being caught. So be prepared for it.
So those that break down are just people who can't stand the monotony of it?
Yes, I would say can't stand the monotony, or if you can, which is what we all like to try and do, is to try and identify the person. And if you can get him doubly identified from two different angles, then of course that is ideal.
So presumably you don't really need a confession if you've got two reliable witnesses.
Except that the two witnesses might have left the jungle several months ago, and this man that you've got was only out yesterday, and you want to know what happened the day before yesterday, and you want to know where everybody is, and how the pattern has changed since 6 months ago. And then you must have that.
Would you get surrendered enemy personnel who would give you a wealth of information.
I think...
For money?
For money, they might.
Have you come across that yourself?
Oh, yes.
What would be their price? How much would you have to offer them?
I can't remember the amounts, but there were laid down figures, depending upon the rank of the person.
But would it be hundreds of pounds or thousands of pounds or what?
It wouldn't be so much. It wouldn't be in thousands. But it could probably run in the equivalent of dollars into several hundred dollars, which would probably be only a few hundred pounds, 300, 400, 500 pounds, maybe something like that, which was a lot of money 30-odd years ago.
Did you find it was money well spent, or did you feel it was wasted?
Well, government laid it down. All you had to do was to make application for the money once you had identified the person who had surrendered or you'd brought in. You didn't... You only paid people who had surrendered. I mean, if they were captured or killed, I mean, nobody got any money. You didn't send £500 to the next of kin of someone you killed because he was an enemy of the country. But if someone responded to the leaflets that were dropped or the Magnavox from the aeroplane, then if you told them, we will give you... And sometimes they would name names whom they knew were in the area. Once you see the application of the emergency, although it took a long time, was quite cleverly worked out. They used, once you had got a battle formation of terrorists, we knew more or less within 10, 20 or maybe 50 miles were almost every single terrorist. There were a few names we obviously hadn't got, but we knew all the leaders. We knew the regimental commanders. They were terribly cautious about their movements, and they're terribly cautious about who would know. I mean, a person way down in the southeast wouldn't know what was happening up in the northeast. You wouldn't get that kind of information being passed through by letter. But letters... They had couriers who, believe it or not, could and did find their way through that impenetrable jungle and knew how to make contact with another group nearby. If you could get somebody, you see, then if that man was ever missing, you had then alternative meeting places that they used that might not be known to the courier who was captured.
Did they ever use codes in their letters?
Yes, frequently. They all, nearly practically always wrote in as it was Chinese and Chinese. But codes, you either guessed at the codes or you could, in some cases, know them. But only from, you know, other terrorists.
What type of information would you get from the letters?
They would refer to successes that they'd had, where they'd ambushed some soldiers and killed them. They would refer to the loss of some of their own companions, which would confirm with us, you see. If you got an unidentified terrorist, for instance, who had been killed, everyone was photographed to start off with. I mean, every dead face was photographed. And if we couldn't get an identification, you didn't keep a body sitting around in that heat for very long, but you got them out pretty quickly, and they used to smell pretty awful too, even when you got them out quickly. But then you'd photograph them, and... if you hadn't got anyone available, if the nearest person surrendered, the terrorist that you had, I mean, he could be a couple of hundred miles away, and you might not want to keep people hanging around, but you get the photograph and any personal belongings.
And fingerprints?
Fingerprints as well, they'd take, yeah.
Were fingerprints of much use?
Not a great deal, because if a person went underground, unless he happened to have a criminal record, you know, there were little purpose in having fingerprints when you've got nothing to match them up with.
Now, after Penang, where did you move to after that?
Now, Penang, from Penang, I think I went on leave. I did, I went on leave again, and that probably would have been about 56, 57. And on return from Penang, I went to Mua, North Johor.
Was this again doing special branch work?
Special branch, yes. Once you're in special branch, you get sort of, unless they find you unsuited to that kind of work, then, I mean, some people, there are two schools. We're friendly with each other, but a lot of people say there's nothing special about special branch except its name, you see. There is a little bit of friendly rivalry between uniform branch and special branch. The uniform branch people, you know, would say, well, you know, that's the best way to hide a policeman, is to stick him in a special branch. You know, they will never know whether he knows anything or not. The special branch used to refer to the uniform branch people as, you know, lock testers and knob pullers, you know, like the old copper here who used to try shop doorknobs and things, see that they're locked at night. It was friendly rivalry. We were all friendly with each other. We never had any disagreement.
But at Mua, you were doing essentially the same kind of work while you were at Penang?
Yes. The job there was you had a police circle, which was a group of districts, and you were responsible for the special branch work. And it used to be known as the CSBO, Circle Special Branch Officer.
How did the situation at Mua compare with Penang? Was it more difficult?
It was a bigger area, in actual fact, and there were more terrorists there, and they were they weren't as compacted as they were in Penang. And there were about four or five groups. And, of course, we bordered with Malacca. So we had the Malacca terrorists. They didn't bother with border lines as we did. As police officers with a special branch, a uniform branch, we observed the border lines of our own districts or circles. And we wouldn't sort of go over and investigate a crime or cross the line into another area unless we told our opposite number that there's something going on in that area. Then he'd come out and he'd join in with you if it was sort of a borderline thing. All you did really was to contact your neighbouring special branch officer there and just have a little chat about how things were going and what movements. In any case, if you'd got a report in recording a movement, then one of the first things you did, apart from sending this information, you had to maintain constant contact, of course, with your state headquarters, who then remained in constant contact with the police headquarters in Kuala Lumpur. You sent a copy of your reports. Where they affected another boundary, you sent your reports to them, so that they could then be aware of the movements there. We all had operations, so they used to be kept under lock and key. We'd have a big board on the wall there, and we'd have a little lock, and then when you wanted to see where the general movements were, you would just unlock the thing and slide the board back. And as you had visiting firemen, if you know what those are.
No.
A visiting fireman is it's just a fun word for someone from headquarters or I don't know, someone who is, you've been told to give some information to. We just call them visiting firemen. if you've got a visiting fireman down and you've got authority to impart some information, you can say, well, this is a situation, you know, and you have pins marking the sightings of movements, and the pins, these I did have some here, about, you know, long pins, plastic, with a round white top, and you write the date on the white top, and then you put a pin where some was seen, and you could follow or trace movement of groups, and then you'd put at the bottom maybe a copy of the report, and some would say, what's that? You would say, well, there was a sighting of three terrorists in this place 3 days ago. And we didn't always get the information. Some people lived in rural areas only, you know, might come in and give you the information. Malays frequently gave it quite voluntarily, but a lot of them were frightened of the terrorists, and you had to get your information the hard way.
Are there any successes or incidents at Muir that you can recount?
Well,
against the guerrillas?
Yes, we like to claim that we started the as the emergency improved from our point of view, we started making what we called white areas. Now, white areas meant that there were the lifting of some emergency restrictions. It meant that curfews were out. It meant that food could be removed from one area to another without permission. And we were very fortunate in having, I can't recall exactly how the information, but we of course you have informers, how can you get your information? And we had an informer who was on a rubber estate, and he was on a rubber estate of a planter with whom I was very friendly. And with him, I agreed that we should get this man on his own. He gave him a particular job to do where he could do it on his own, and I went out and met him there so that he was not under suspicion. And he gave information which eventually led us to a very senior man who said that he was fed up and he wanted to come out. We got him out, and he then announced that he would be prepared to get other people out. Now, there was a group in Yongpeng, which is in Johor further down. They were a most villainous and violent group, and they were known as Number 7 Platoon. Number 7 Platoon, no one could believe. They were so well led and so vicious that they were prepared to surrender. I was then called up to my state headquarters whilst we discussed this, and we got messages sent backwards and forwards, and then we agreed that we would go into the jungle led by one of these surrendered terrorists to a particular point that was agreed upon by letter, and I went with one interpreter myself, and we made a little camp of our own, and we waited for 2 days, and lo and behold, in came about 28 terrorists from Number 7 Platoon, all armed to the teeth. Very frightening moment, because we had no means of contact with anybody. We were told not to go in armed at all, and eventually the man that we brought in with us was a former very senior communist terrorist, in one way or other he had been, we hoped and thought, and we were quite right, fully brainwashed or fully prepared to accept the circumstances. He'd seen the outside life. he didn't have to believe any more hogwash because he could see people living easily and pleasantly and the good life that was outside. And there were Chinese living that good life as well. And it took, I think, the best part. They came out in the early morning, the best part of the whole day. We had a wireless, and they said, don't bring them out until you know for certain that they want to surrender. Well, they still had their weapons with them, and they were still arguing it out. They were squatting down with this man talking to them. My golly, talk non-stop, incessantly, for hours on end. And my interpreter, my inspector, who was Chinese, he came over to me and said, I think we're getting somewhere at last, but he said, we haven't convinced them yet. So there were one or two questions they wanted to ask through me, and I was able to satisfy them. There were simple questions: what's going to happen to us, will we go in jail or so and so on. And they said, of course you won't, no, you've got my promise, my word. And eventually in the late evening we got them all to lay down their arms. And we sent a message through on the wireless to ask them to get some vehicles sent to a point on the side of the road in the jungle, and we marched out. I think it was the following morning we marched out, and they loaded onto the vehicles and went back to headquarters, where they were received, given a meal. Needless to say, they weren't put in jail, but they were put in huts that were on the outside, that were barbed wire on the outside, and they were obviously sentries.
Was that in 1957, do you think?
Yes, it was 57 or 58.
And it was near Yongping?
Yongping was the area, and we then, as a result of that, we then rolled up the terrorists from Moore. When they heard that Yongping had collapsed, because they were such a violent group, and they thought they were the last people to surrender, but they had surrendered, then we rolled up the whole of Johor, except for one pocket in Kota Tinggi.
Why do you think that group of seven platoons surrendered?
I think that they were persuaded by the person whom we had gone in with, who was a senior man, and that the emergency, from the government's point of view, was looking far brighter than it ever had done. It wasn't at its worst. There were less killings, and I think they were also suffering from the withdrawal of a number of people who were fed up and were coming from the jungle into...
What did they look like?
They had a way of keeping themselves fairly fit. They all wore their uniforms. They used to make the uniforms in the jungle. People used to supply them with cloth. They had little sewing machines there. They had little those little caps that looked like the Japanese wore, close fitting khaki caps with a red star on the front of them. They had no badges of rank as such, but